The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, it's more than nice to come back here to where you all are practicing and engaged in the quiet, the engagement, the intention that's here, the goodness that's here. It's quite a special thing to come into a community of people who are practicing. And there are a lot of people up the road. And I drove down from Berkeley along 880. It's a lot of people. A lot of cars. A lot of heat. A lot of world out there. And I'd be hard put to drive around the neighborhoods around the freeway 880 between Berkeley and here and find this many people sitting practicing quietly and peacefully engaged in this kind of practice. It's more than nice to come here and join you. There is a delightful sutta where the Buddha is going to visit three monastics who are practicing in the woods, kind of a park-like setting. They call it a park in the translations. And it's also a time when he went to visit practitioners. And these people are kind of on retreat. You'll see as we go through this. And what makes this story kind of peculiar is the Buddha is walking towards the park, and the park keeper says to the Buddha, he doesn't recognize who the Buddha is, and he says, a recluse. You know, renunciant. You know, hey you. You know, don't come in here. There are these three monks who are practicing in here diligently, and we want to leave them alone to practice. So I came back here today, and no one told me that. But if no one had recognized me, someone might have said that. I'd been a stranger to this place. Don't go in there. The people are practicing. But these three monastics here, they can hear, overhear this conversation, so they come out and tell the park keeper, no, this is our teacher who's visiting. So they come out to talk to the Buddha, say hello, and they prepare a place for the Buddha to come and sit and bring some water, and they sit down. And the Buddha says to them, I hope you are all keeping well. I hope you are all comfortable. I hope you are not having any trouble getting alms food. So he's concerned about their welfare. It seems like a nice, simple, caring thing to do. How are you getting along? I left one word out in reading that, and that is he addresses all three monks by the name of one of them, Anuruddha. It's a little peculiar that to refer to all three of them but say, you guys, an Anuruddha. But you'll see that this has some meaning as we go along. They say to the Buddha in reply, we are keeping well, we are comfortable, and we are not having any trouble getting alms food. So it's a happy story, a happy time for them in this nice park setting, practicing, and then they're doing well. Their needs are being taken care of. Then the Buddha says, I hope, Anuruddha, addressing all three of them, I hope, Anuruddha, that you are all living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. You know, he's concerned about their welfare, and now he's asking about how are you living. Practically, they're in good shape, but how are you living together in community? I could have come in and ask you all that. I hope you're all living here in this second full day in Concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. It's a you know, beautiful sentiment for how people can live together in community. And they say, they reply to the Buddha, surely, this is how we're living. And then the Buddha asks them, but how do you live this way? How does this work for you? And they say, Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. This is how I think. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me, that I am living with such companions in the holy life. That's a beautiful idea to reflect. This is pretty special, to be together with people who are practicing, engaged. And I mean, it's hard enough to find people who are willing to be silent for, you know, 2 minutes, let alone for 2 weeks. It's pretty special, you know. Some of us like to be left alone, so it's pretty good. And to be engaged in a practice like this, and it's kind of a practice of honesty, showing up in an honest way to what our life is really like, and it's a phenomenal thing. So to recognize it's a great thing for me. I'm benefiting from it. Great benefit for me to be able to be in this kind of environment. And I know for me, in my years of doing lots of retreats, I could not have done as much practice as I did without the support and the benefit of doing it with others. Even when times were difficult to be living with others, it was still, I couldn't have done it without them. So the first day, I think, it's a gain for me, it's a great gain, that I'm living with such companions in the holy life. And so I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately, secretly. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. So that's kind of the general kind of attitude of how to live in community that these people are doing. They consider, you know, what's the friendly thing to do? What's a friendly way to think about them, the kind way, or how to have goodwill to the people you're sharing the practice with. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind. It's also very nice. Different in body, but one in mind. One in what we're interested in, how we're thinking about each other. There's a kind of a unification that goes on there. And this idea of living together in certain kind of harmony, living together as one in a certain way, by being concerned for the welfare of each other, thinking about others, and putting aside one's own self-concern in a certain way for the benefit of others, is, it's kind of a universal teaching that many societies have one way or the other, this kind of idea. And this is where we get this idea that they're all referred to by the name Anuruddha. They're three different people. They have three different names, actually. They're given names, they're all given here. But they're all called Anuruddha, I think, to emphasize this idea that they're all kind of one in a certain way. I think Anuruddha is the most senior one. And then these other, they're named here, Venerable Nandiya and Venerable Kimbila, each spoke likewise. So they said exactly the same thing. They're really in it together. And elsewhere it says that these three lived together for years, many, many years, and they were born in the same town and got ordained around the same time. And so they really knew each other well. And so the Buddha's replies to this, what they say, good, good, probably excellent, excellent. I hope you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. Ardent was one of the words that Andrea talked about yesterday. be all diligent, ardent, and resolute. And a little bit, that's and elsewhere, it's kind of a little attitude for engaging on retreat, practicing in this kind of way, with that kind of attitude. And they say, surely we do. And then the Buddha asks, but how do you do this? And this is also very nice with the Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over. If that one wishes, whichever of us returns last eats whatever food is left over, if we want. Otherwise, we throw it away where there is no greenery, or drop it into the water where there's no life. He puts away the seats and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whichever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or latrine are low or empty, takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. So they're on silent retreat, and they're figuring out how to take care of their things. If they see a need that needs to be done, they take care of it, because they're taking care of their community. They're one in three in body, but one in mind. If you take care of your community, you take care of yourself. You take care. So here you are, caring for people. But they're on silent retreat. And isn't that kind of nice? Like I said, people have been doing this for a long time. Except, every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. This is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. So I guess we could, but maybe we'll settle for the Dharma talk. The reason I'm referring to this here is that it's kind of the foundation, certain kind of foundation for engaging in practice, certain kind of preparation for it. Andrea talked very nicely yesterday about how that preparation and how that foundation is set up in the Satipatthana Sutta. And this is a little different, very different kind of approach to kind of as a preparation, a kind of a little bit more in the world, the conditions you're in, and that this is actually an important part of establishing ourselves here in a supportive way, to have this kind of attitude in the community you have, appreciation for the opportunity and a certain level of basic goodwill, or at least a wish to have goodwill, and that you care for each other, which you are doing. All of you have work meditations and sangha service jobs, and it's part of your taking care of things, and we're living here together practicing. And then the Buddha goes on to say, excellent, excellent. But while you abide this thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, and I'll paraphrase the rest, do you get concentrated? Because they're on the retreat, after all. And so they say yes. And then they describe, their concentration they're doing. And with that, I want to switch to the Satipatthana Sutta. Because this is the way we're getting concentrated, the way we're focusing or engaging is with the practice of this four establishments of mindfulness, with the engaging with mindfulness. So, and historically, in the time of the Buddha, mindfulness practice was basically synonymous with doing concentration practice. There wasn't a really sharp distinction between the two of them. So just you give yourself over, turn yourself over to being mindful, and the settling, the unification, the absorption into your experience that you know, we associate with concentration will happen just as well, to go deeper and deeper into it if you enter into this more and more deeply. And so in the Satipatthana Sutta, it begins by the first kind of real, kind of more concrete instructions about what to do about mindfulness of breathing, kind of an anapanasati instruction. And I'll read a piece of it. So the first foundation, the first establishment of mindfulness is contemplating or observing the body as the body and the body. And it says here, and how does one abide contemplating the body as a body? Here, someone gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut sits down, folding one's legs crosswise, sets one's body erect, and having established mindfulness to the forefront, ever mindful breathes in, ever mindful breathes out. The idea of you enter into the some place that's suitable to practice, enter into the forest, enter into a wilderness area, an empty place, empty building. And so, you know, this building is qualifies good enough. We enter in here and then we sit up, and the set one's body erect is, in the Zen world where I practice, sitting upright was taken to be a metaphor for an attitude. They sit really straight in Zen, but more important for them was the idea of an attitude of being upright in the middle of anything, even if you couldn't sit up, even if you had to lay down. The idea is that there's an uprightness, there's a certain dignity, certain balance, certain strength maybe in the middle of what's happening, that we don't get pushed around by it, or we don't get caught in it, or we don't slump, you know, psychologically in the middle of it, but we stay kind of rooted or upright or there for the experience. So there's a certain kind of attitude of being erect, upright, that's called upon in this practice. And I think of it as a, you know, calling on a certain strength or maturity or you know, ardent, diligent, and resolute with this. And and similar as Andrea talked about yesterday about putting away desire and discontent about the world, it's also this kind of not being caught up in the concerns of the world, not be so preoccupied with things that are outside of here, in the future, the past, or things that we can call worldly concerns. Not that doing so is necessarily wrong, but that's not where the path of practice is going to unfold and deepen. There has to be some willingness to turn our thoughts away, turn our attention, at least turn our attention away from what we're concerned about in the world, what we like, what we don't like, so that we can really more fully enter into this world, enter the forest, into the body, into the breathing. So it's not an aversion, it's not a, you know, saying you can't think about the world, think about things, you will. We can't stop the mind so easily. But the idea is that that's not where our interest is. At least while we're here, there's a choice that's made, a kind of a decision that's made, that my interest, what I'm about here, is not to think about the world out there, what's out there. It's to really try to be in the lived experience that's here, right now, upright, rooted here in this experience in a full way. Of course, it's, you know, you'll think about the world. As I said, you can't stop it. And this is, you're not wrong because you make a decision to be here and your mind goes there. But you're not in, that's, you kind of know, you know that even though the mind has that in mind, that's not what you're committed to. It's not what you're interested in. It's not what you're deciding to do. And you have to work compassionately and in a relaxed way and wise way with what the mind does. But, you know, at least you know the choice is to be here, to wake up to this experience as a present moment experience. So there is a kind of preparation into this world of Satipatthana. And part of the preparation is, in Satipatthana, is to do this turning towards entering our experience in a deep way and entering into the experience of breathing, ever mindful, breathing in, ever mindful, breathing out. So I want to read a poem by the German poet Rilke that I'm kind of really fond of this little verse. I think it's very evocative. He writes, "You who let yourself feel, enter the breathing that is more than your own." So first, the you, he's like pointing you out. And I think, I suspect in writing this, he's talking to himself. And there's something about talking, you know, that saying you to yourself, which has a kind of evocative idea. What's that about? You know, what? But you who let yourself feel. So we're capable of feeling. We're capable of sensing as much as we're capable of thinking. And here he's evoking the capacity to feel, not the capacity to think. So you who let yourself feel, can you? And also I love that, let yourself, allow yourself to feel. You who can do this, allow yourself to feel. Enter the breathing. That's in this feeling world, this experiential world of sensing and the body. Enter into the breathing. So in my mind, reading this, is I get the sense like diving in, like in a wonderful, peaceful, inspiring forest. Enter into the forest where the monks are meditating. But enter into the breathing, you know, it's kind of like making your attention go smaller, narrowing the focus in a certain way, just the world of breathing, just that. But then he says, enter the breathing that is more than your own. And suddenly you're out in the big world. You know, if it's what is more than your own? What part of breathing is more than your own? The world maybe you don't identify with as yours, but as you, or the wider world. This idea that, sometimes in practice we come in, and as we come in, it opens up to something much, much wider. We come in to retreat, and we, you know, our world is kind of small here, about 3 acres. This room, and you know, in some ways you allow yourself to come into a smaller space. And some people, from time to time, will come into this room and their minds gets, their awareness gets so expansive. It's like the most expansive thing in the universe, in this little room. There's kind of turning to something smaller so that we can kind of go, kind of almost like you go through into a bigger universe, a bigger world in the process. And this idea, this bigger thing you come into, is much, you know, is more than your own, more than your idea of self, more than some fixed idea that we have that's been limiting us for a long time. It's entering into being, letting go of fixed ideas, letting go of fixed concepts of self and all kinds of things. Willingly, allowingly, not fighting, not being in conflict with anything, but kind of settling in. So then we breathe. The first thing it says, ever mindful breathing in, ever mindful breathing out. And this is also very evocative, the idea that it's possible that the capacity for being aware can stay present, stay awake, stay alert enough that we can kind of ride continuously breathing in and breathing out. And for most people, when they begin meditating or begin a retreat, that's part of the training, is to train the mind, develop the mind, so there can be continuity with the breathing. Stay with it. And the art of this is to learn how to train the mind, both strengthen the mind from repetitive work of it, but a lot of it has to do with relaxing the mind, the tension of the mind. A very relaxed, alert mind that is sitting quietly doing nothing else, sooner or later will find the breathing, because it's the biggest event, you know, it's the biggest physical event of the moment. You know, if you're able to put aside your thoughts and all that, it's, you know, it's probably one of the most entertaining things of the moment, just breathing in and breathing out, and your mind will go there. And but to be able to stay there continuously, or you know, attempt to do so, is a great support. And one of the ways it supports us, it's one way that we can learn to leave ourselves alone. And that's part of the art, is to do it in such a way that we are leaving ourselves alone. And what I mean by that is that it's so easy to get caught up in our thoughts, and our desires, and our aversions, our fears, our anxieties, our fantasies, our resentments, or, you know, trying to resolve the past, trying to create a better future, all kinds of things that we're involved in. We can be reacting to things that are here, thinking about issues, solving, wondering, doing all kinds of things. And we're kind of not in the world of feeling, we're in the world of thoughts and ideas, which is not where the opening of practice occurs. It's not that that world is wrong, but it tends to be a limited world. We tend to limit ourselves by that, and we're actually less than who we are if we spend too much time in, you know, preoccupied in our thoughts. So the more we can stay with the breathing, the less we're pouring the energy of attention, energy of our mind, into our desires and fears and thoughts and all these things. That world is also a world, that the thinking and thoughts and ideas, we're often trying to fix things, or get things, or acquire things, or make things happen. this idea, so we're not leaving ourselves alone. We have agendas, we have purposes, we're trying to do too much. And it can be quite challenging if we're too, you know, trying to fix ourselves too much while we're trying to meditate. Meditation is almost like giving up fixing. That's why I like to think that, you know, it's actually better not to be too good at meditation, because if you try to be too good at it, you just mess it up. You know, it's like, you know, if you remember what it was like to first learn to ride a bike, you know, it's kind of wobbly and you're holding on tight and it's kind of like, you know, difficult to do. But once you get skilled at it, you don't want to try riding the bike too hard. You're not in the same struggling way you did when you first tried to learn wobble. If you try too hard, you know, grip the handlebars really tight because you're so scared or something, and, you know, it's, you kind of mess yourself up. But you want to kind of, as you get better and better, you kind of relax, and self-consciousness falls away, and trying to do it just right falls away, and it just becomes kind of second nature to do it. So this idea of kind of settling into the experience of breathing, and seemingly, if we can, let go of self-consciousness. Let go of the agendas and ideas and thoughts. You know, leave ourselves alone. And part of that, how this works, is by being really simple. You know, to be with the breathing as simple as you can. Breathing in and breathing out. And then there's for a while I used to, when I was new to all this, I used to do the checklist approach to meditation. So I knew I was supposed to stay with the in-breaths and the out-breaths. And so I would just be there for a moment, done that. And then I would let my mind go until the out-breath came, because then I would done that. And then I let my mind do something else with my mind, waiting for the in-breath to begin, done that. And they're like, this moment here, you know, and like, you know, 1/10 or 1/100th of the time that I was breathing in, it was spent, you know, checking it off. But the idea is to really kind of savor or stay, ride the experience of inhalation, stay the whole length. And then there's the transition to breathing out. Stay there for the whole exhale. And different people, maybe, you know, some people appreciate different parts of that cycle. I appreciate the exhale the most. there's, for me, there's something about the letting go of that, just like, yeah, I just kind of ride that letting go. And I really like at the end of the exhale to kind of just appreciate that letting go at the end of the exhale, because then there's a little bit more letting go, just a teeny bit more. Like, it's like I'm not even trying to hold the breath, and not forcing it. It's just like kind of letting go more fully. And there's something about allowing that little bit more full in-breath or out-breath in a natural way, which starts having all kinds of physiological and neurological beneficial things for us. There's something about as the breath slows down, it gets longer, that it regulates all kinds of places in the brain, that very primitive place in the brain that creates very soothing, comfortable feelings in the body. It's a very deep connection between breathing and our physiology. And so to kind of just kind of ride the breath, be with the breath, stay there. Even if there's ever a slightest little pause or gap between breathing out and breathing in, breathing in and breathing out, it's really nice to just kind of be there for it, to recognize it. And just a simple recognition of that little gap. That's all. You don't have to do anything or try to extend the gap. That little recognition kind of allows there to be a little bit more space around the breathing, a little more space around the gap, which supports this process of settling, peacefulness, and involvement with the breathing. Rilke writes this poem. Breath, you invisible poem. Have you ever thought of your breathing as a poem? I find that so evocative. Like, that's like, oh, what if you thought of it as a poem? Your body's, you know, reciting poetry to you in your with your breathing. Would you pay attention more carefully then? Would you be more interested? What is that poem? But he said, anyway, so he writes, breath, you invisible poem, pure continuous exchange with all that is, flow and counterflow, where rhythmically I come to be. In the earlier one, he talks about becoming more than your own. And here, the pure continuous exchange with all that is. So breathing is like, you know, we need to breathe more than we need to drink or to eat. It's like crucial to stay alive, to keep the breathing thing going. And luckily, there's so much more supply than what we need. We just need a small little percentage of the supply that's around us. But we take it in, and there's an exchange that goes on with the world around us. And we take that whole thing for granted, something we need so intimately, so important for us. Generally, we're fortunate that we don't have to think about it or be conscious about it or kind of figure out how to do it. But still, we take it so for granted. But in so many spiritual circles, there's something about entering into the world of breathing that opens up a new world. And this exchange, when I was a little kid, about 5 years old, I was outdoors with my father, and he explained to me that, I forget exactly how he said to me, but there's so many, in one swallow of air you take in, one inhalation, there's so many, you know, astounding number of particles of air that comes in. And because there's such an astounding great number, and when it goes out, it gets mixes around and travels around the globe, and that the chances are that, the way he told me back then, was that as we're breathing in air particles that Julius Caesar breathed in. Because statistically, that's probably so, because of, you know, how it all spreads. So many, right? So that was kind of that's pretty cool, I thought. But nowadays, I think sometimes that we're breathing in the air that our ancestors breathed in and out. We're sharing. And here, you know, we're a conspiracy here. Literally, this conspiracy means to breathe in and out. We're sharing such intimate things. We'd rather not think about it here. But, you know, we're breathing the air that comes in and out. And pure continuous exchange with all that is. That's, I think, evocative words, evocative ideas. Flow and counterflow, just flowing in and flowing out, staying with it, being with it, resting with it. Where rhythmically, I love the idea of the rhythm of breathing. And for me, it helps me to stay present for breathing. When I ask myself, what's the rhythm here? I kind of tune into the rhythm of coming in and out. And let that rhythm massage me. Let the rhythm of flow, rhythm of movement, the sensations of expanding and contracting of the chest or the belly, let it kind of be a massage, that rhythm that works me in. So the flow and counterflow where rhythmically I come to be. I think it's also evocative. For me, reading this, the flow and the counterflow, the rising and passing, the coming and going, we come to be, but we also disappear. We arise and we disappear. There's something about that's very similar to the rhythm of breathing, where actually we ourselves have a rhythm of coming into a certain kind of being, into, and then we kind of, everything dissolves, come into being and dissolve. Here we are. Rilke also writes, maybe I'll read this a little later, the last little verse of his. So, and so part of the training is very simple, just to kind of try to stay more continuously with the breathing. And to do it in a way that we're not, you know, doing it too self-consciously, in a way that we tie ourselves up, or we're concerned about getting anything, or concerned about being successful, or trying too hard. But also not kind of spending a lot of time kind of, you know, measuring yourself, am I doing well enough? And there's a just a kind of radical simplicity. Not trying to do too good a job, but allowing the possibility that you relax and settle into it more and more, just staying with it. And but kind of a being resolute, ardent, diligent in your idea, this is the world I want to enter into for now. Not the world of thinking and thoughts and memories and fixing and planning and all that. And again, not because it's wrong to do those things. It's not the world that we're entering into and exploring. We're actually learning a different skill. We're learning a skill, capacity, of not being attached to that world or glued to it, or learning how not to get preoccupied in that world and discover something much bigger and freer. In the Satipatthana Sutta, this bigger world that it's pointing to is referred to a little bit like this. And one abides independent. Right here it says, mindfulness is established, is simply established, to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and lucid awareness. Just enough to be present fully here. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how a person abides contemplating the body as a body. So, you know, to enter into this world of breathing, because it's a way, what we're trying to do is to use the breathing, the staying with the breathing, to help us relax the clinging, the holding, the grasping that the mind has. But to do it lovingly, with kindness. To not do it forcefully and with great expectation that you're going to succeed quickly. But to just gently, steadily, continuously. This is the world we enter, the world of breathing. For this first exercise here of Satipatthana. And then it begins describing a four-step process. The first tetrad of Anapanasati that some of you know. And it goes like this. Breathing in long, breathing in a long breath, one understands I breathe in long. or breathing out long, one understands, I breathe out long. It's pretty simple. It's not like very not like a complicated thing. If you have a long inhalation, you know it's long. You recognize it as it is. If you have a long exhalation, you recognize it, that's what it is. So here there's a little bit more than just being mindful, ever mindful of breathing in, breathing out. Now we're calling in a little bit the power of recognition. A little bit like now we're kind of recognizing that this is what the experience is like. Now that I can stay with it a little bit for a while, now I'm getting to know it better. This is what it's like for me. And there's many things to know. You can feel that, you can feel the movements of relaxation, the movement of contraction, feel the warmth, the coolness, the tingling, the pressure, the release of pressure, the movements that flow. You know, when the chest expands, when the belly expands as you breathe in, what is that movement like? What are the different sensations that come into play? There's a kaleidoscope of sensations that come into play as we breathe. And at some point, as we get, at some point, and that important thing to say is at some point, as we kind of get, you know, more and more into the experience of breathing, and it gets easier and easier to stay there, then to allow to be a richer recognition, a richer registering of what's actually happening there. Some people can get quite good at staying present for the breathing, but they're kind of vague about what that experience is like. They're kind of like, oh, I'm doing my duty, I'm kind of here, and just kind of like, it's all a mush, it's all a cloud, and it's all good. But at some point, the idea is to have a certain recognition, this is what's happening. But again, it's supposed to be very simple, very relaxed, but when the time is right, to start seeing, oh, like this. And so when it's long, recognize it's long. And then it goes on to say, when one breathes in a short inhalation, one understands, I breathe in short. When one breathes out short, one understands, I breathe out short. So you can start seeing these differences. And in fact, one of the common patterns, there's all kinds of patterns, they take different way things unfold, but a fairly common one is people meditate, is that the breathing sometimes will start being kind of short and tight, and then as we relax, it becomes longer and more relaxed and more fuller. And then as we settle in further, then it starts getting shorter again. And more, shallow again, or shallow is the right word, but shorter and shorter, and because we need less and less breath, and so after a while, it just gets a very slight kind of breathing. So it takes different patterns. So we can recognize, one of the things we can recognize, oh look, now it's like this, the breathing, now it's like this, it changes. I find it always fascinating. It's a regular thing I do when I sit down to meditate, is to be curious, well, what's my breathing like now? Because, especially when I live a life, my life affects my breathing. And so I'm always curious, how has my life affected me today? And I come down and notice, that I'm breathing a certain way, a certain speed, certain kind of shallow or deep, certain tensions, holding patterns somewhere connected to my breathing. So I just get curious, what's this like? And then I know that and be with that. I don't usually try to fix it. I just try to know it and be with it. So the first step of this process of going deeper into the breath, entering more deeply, is to kind of really get curious and interested. What is this like? Enter into more fully into the experience itself, the richness or the variety of experiences that come into play, the kaleidoscope and of sensations that come and go, the rhythm in which all kinds of things come and go and appear and disappear. Each breath, there's a whole world that arises and passes. Then the next step in these processes is as you get more and more familiar with, enter the world, more familiar with it, then the tendency is to start becoming more aware of your body. There's often that, if for those people who like to stay with their breathing as a focal point, as we settle in and relax into it, the awareness begins to open up and we start becoming more fully aware of the body. And that's what the instructions are. So after getting familiar with the breath and steadying the attention on the breathing, then one trains as follows. I should breathe in, experiencing the whole body. I should breathe out, experiencing the whole body. And there's two interpretations of what this means. One is that you just allow yourself to experience the full experience of breathing in whatever that way it means for you. Whether it's continuously from beginning to end of the inhalation, the beginning to end of the exhalation, wherever you're focusing on it. So it's more like, you know, there's no gap. As fully as you can enter into the world. And you enter into it not by straining, but it's a lot of it has to do with letting go and relaxing into it. Letting go into the breathing. Just letting go of thoughts is maybe not enough. Let go of thoughts and then let go into the experience of breathing. And so that to full experience. Sometimes, for some people, it's experiencing the breath kind of throughout kind of the body, the full kind of sphere in which the body sensations come into play as you're breathing. So you might feel it in your chest, your shoulders, in your belly, in your nostrils, back of your throat. Sometimes when the breathing is large enough, you can feel it down into your pelvic area. There's slight movements of pressure and release of pressure, the back, all kinds of places that you can feel that rhythm operating and the movement. And another interpretation of experiencing the whole body is literally that, is you keep breathing. It's kind of like having a primary focus on the experience of breathing, but then have a peripheral awareness that becomes aware of the whole body as much as broadly as you can in a relaxed way. And so it's kind of like the broad container that holds it all. And it's possible to have this peripheral vision, kind of, whereas the primary focus stays on the breathing through it and with it. And this use of a peripheral vision is very helpful for meditation, because it's not just to be 100% focused on one thing, but to be, you know, fully present as you can on one thing, but then open to what's happening around you, so that you can notice a little bit when you get caught, when you start thinking, when you, you know, start reacting to something. So you know what's happening, but also you can know this wider body as you breathe. And because that's just very helpful because of the next instruction, as you get to know it. One trains thus. I shall breathe in. They use the word tranquilizing in this translation, which I can never get used to. That I'm, you know, I feel like I should take a tranquilizer. So I prefer to read it this way. I shall breathe in, relaxing the bodily formation. I shall breathe out, relaxing the bodily formation. So here, this is one of the most intentional things that we're doing in this instruction, that we're actually trying to do something rather than just to know something, is we're being instructed to relax. Isn't that nice? However, to relax while sitting erect. There is something uprightness and certain kind of, you know, presence that we want to stay alert in the middle of, because you don't want to just, you know, slump and be relaxed that way. You want to kind of maintain a certain kind of balance if you can. But then also to relax. And I read many years ago that a study where, I guess, physiologists were studying the musculature of a body to see in what postures human bodies could relax the deepest in. And the two postures that allowed for the deepest relaxation was the corpse posture in yoga, and sitting cross-legged like this. You wouldn't normally think sitting upright is as good as laying down. But in fact, if you can learn to sit upright, even in a chair, in a nice, balanced way, there's something that allows the musculatures to let go as deeply, to then relax deeply. And so to soften the belly, to relax the belly. It's good to have a soft belly as you meditate. To relax the jaws. When I used to have a lot of tensions in my jaws, I would drop my mouth open as meditating, and then I would float the mouth back together. Just the lips or the teeth just barely touched. And that kind of dropping open, then floating it together, would help keep the jaw not so tense. Or the shoulders. And, you know, and I don't have, unless it's, you know, gross, I can't intentionally relax my shoulders. But I can be aware that they're tense. So what I do is, rather than relaxing them, I soften around my shoulders. And, you know, that's the sense I'm softening around them. And it's kind of like making space for the shoulders to relax themselves if they would like, when they'd like. Just be there with it. So there's relaxing the bodily formations. Bodily formations here, what I understand it to mean, is that parts of the body that are activated because of what the mind does. You know, there's a connection between mind and body, right? So if I'm scared, I pull in, maybe. So there's a lot of muscles get activated through a lifetime, and some of them get chronically held. And one of the nice things about deep meditation is this deep patterns of holding that we can have built into our body has a chance to relax and soften and let go. It can be very healing to do that. So these steps of being with the long breath, the short breath, being aware of the whole body, and then relaxing the bodily formations, involves a three-part steps, which is built into a lot of other instructions the Buddha gives. And that is first, just recognize what's there, then feel it more fully, and then let go. Recognize what's happening, and so that recognize is not, don't do the checklist approach, done that. But to recognize means take a few hours to, you know, take your time to really see what's there. Don't be in a hurry. Be at ease. Be relaxed. Find a way to be equanimous, or just be present, simple. Get to know it. Take your time. Don't be in a hurry. Don't be acquisitive. Don't try to fix things. Just take your time, because there's more going on here than what you can manage to orchestrate. We're creating conditions for something deep inside of us to move and unfold and evolve and develop. So don't be too caught up in you're the doer of all this. And so first take your time to recognize what's happening. And then take your time to feel it fully, sense it, experience it. And that's a little different than recognizing. It's kind of being in the midst of it, allowing it to really be there, and, you know, let yourself feel, as Rilke said. Be there. It's a powerful training just to do that, because it's a training to stay present. But it's also very helpful, because you're really allowing the inner life to live, to show itself, to experience itself. And also allowing what's in there to surface, to make room for what's in there. The Dharma knows what you need to experience. Get out of the way. Make space for it, make room for it. And then this letting go. And that's different places, there's different ways that's said. And this, what I just read, it's relaxing. Other places it's letting go. Other places abandoning. Letting things fall away. It's different things that, to different times, different situations, different ones of these movements. You know, words represent what the movement is like. And so here's the last verse from Rilke. And again, I think he's talking to himself in this verse, but maybe he's talking to part of you, or to you. Quiet friend who has come so far. Quiet friend. He's talking to himself. Who's the quiet friend that's come so far, come all this journey with you, your whole lifetime? What is it? What's inside of you that's accompanying you all this time, that's quiet and you hardly know it's there, that is more than what you identify with, who you think you are, what you're going to be conscious of? And in Buddhism, we don't want to reify that into something like a, but maybe it's a process, the deeper process of how consciousness and physiology and our life development works. So much of it, big percentage of it, happens offline. We don't see it. But this whole kind of subconscious, unconscious, this whole bigger piece of what makes us work, call it quiet friend. It's your friend. And in fact, this is one of the things I've learned from this practice, is to really trust what unfolds when I can be present and mindful for the experience. It's really a powerful thing to trust and allow this quiet friend, this inner movement, sometimes I call it the Dharma that's within, to make space for it and let it move. Quiet friend who has come so far, feel how your breathing makes more space around you. We have in English the expression, making breathing room. It's a great expression. Breathing room, room to breathe. But we get much more than just room to breathe. We get room to live in. We get room to think. We get room to kind of be alive in when we have breathing room. Feel how your breathing makes more space around you. There's something about entering into the world of breathing and the simplicity of it and just trusting that you can just be with it and without needing to do a lot or fix anything and just let yourself breathe in and out and in and out. You kind of relax. All the movements that say, this is not good enough, I'm more sophisticated, I need something bigger to do, I need to get there sooner, I have other more important things to think about, you know, and all kinds of that whole, to see all those things operating and see them operate and learn to let go of them. Learn to, no, not now. Learn to relax back into the simple experience of breathing. And at first, it can be a lot of arguments about this is silly. You know, this is like just breathing. I mean, it's like nothing. It's like the most mundane thing I've ever done in my life. You know, there's important things to do and important websites to visit. And just that breathing, I mean, gee. But there's something physiologically and neurologically it happens that if we enter into simplicity of it and that's all we do, there's a kind of feeling of satisfaction, of well-being, of healing, of goodness, of rightness that's just there. It takes its time. Don't expect it. Don't feel bad that it doesn't happen quickly. But it is very encouraging to know that there's this whole process in here that's available over time, with time, but it comes from beginning so simple. Be willing to be simple, just breathing, being that experience. And then with time, the breathing becomes freer and freer, more easeful. And the Buddha has this word that he used, Pali is asasa. And it's a word that can mean to breathe easily. And I love it that there's a single word for breathing easily. But it's also used figuratively by the Buddha to mean to be reassured, to be assured. Dictionary says it also means to be confident. But I like the idea of being reassured or assured. When we feel assured or reassured, then we can feel safe, we can feel at ease, and we can breathe easily. So I'll end with saying this little story that I was 21 years old when I decided I'd learn to breathe. I had been breathing for 21 years. I had never thought about my breathing, but then at some point I felt, wow, this is like, now I know how to breathe. And I was living in a small dairy farm in Norway, and it was nestled in a kind of valley, green mountains and cliffs around us and small fields. And either end of the valley were these two fjords, Norwegian fjords. And so it was a very simple time before the internet, before screens. Probably had a radio, but no TV. And I did a lot of work out in the fields, working outdoors a lot. If I wasn't working outdoors, I was hiking in the mountains. And in that life, I noticed at some point my breathing started to flow easily and smoothly and completely, and there's no resistance to it, the sense of easeful breath. But why I'm telling you the story is that I noticed at the same time that my sense of vision became more broad, wider. It's like my sense of vision got expansive. Even if I was looking at something, it felt like there was space around everything. There was a room for everything. There was a room for me, room for what was going on around me. And I think there was a correlation between entering into the world of breathing and having the breathing be relaxed and open, that my sense of vision and sense of my got more open, expansive, present, partly because I was no longer preoccupied with my thoughts, no longer caught up in this little world that we're so capable of, still capable of falling into. So this coming in, relaxing, opening, staying with the breath, gentle, loving, and then finding it that opens up into a broad, expansive world that's so much bigger than breathing, but includes all of us. In a world where we're on retreat together, different in body, but maybe someday one in heart. And we can be diligent, ardent, and resolute in being kind to each other, supportive, have goodwill for each other. So let's get reestablished in the mindfulness for a moment. May you have a soft landing onto your breathing. A soft landing into this moment.